had some crazy weather over the last few days, and with the Friday Trail Report, we have Charlie Sturgis on the line. Good morning, Charlie.
Good morning, Sean. How are you today?
I'm doing well. I was getting ready to break out the mountain bike, and then all of a sudden we get over a foot of snow. What's with this?
Yeah, well, you know, I think you got to do as the mountains dictate, right? So, yeah, admittedly, I didn't get a chance to get out and ski yesterday, and I was certainly thinking about it. So, yeah, I think it's probably, you know, don't put your ski equipment away too fast, especially like Adam said, the month of April is the wettest month of the year. So the mountains tend to still accumulate snow. You know, the good news is it does mean that we are going to be up on Bonanza Flat at least one more time. We thought our last weekend was going to be last weekend was it. And I talked with Rick this morning, and we're going to at least go up there and make one more attempt. And then we really do need to start focusing on summer operations a little bit more. But at the moment, summer operations kind of shut down. So, you know, my advice, you know, if you have the opportunity to go south and enjoy the sunshine down south, sounds like a pretty good thing to do. Otherwise, I think we are going to be in kind of ski mode. We're certainly not going to be in bike mode. Maybe by Saturday, Sunday afternoons, you might be good for riding on the pavement around here, which is, you know, not the worst thing that can happen to somebody. So anyhow, I think we're just going to have to persevere. It's kind of spring is always iffy, and it's the mud season and all those good things. So if you've been enjoying Bonanza Flat and you haven't been up there, get up there this weekend. And also, I just want to give a shout out to my buddy Dave Hanscom here in town. You know, kind of our king of the Nordic world. It's his 80th birthday today, and we can all try to aspire to being so fit at 80 as he is. So, wish him the best. That's it. And get out there, have fun.
Absolutely, springtime in the mountains. You never know what you're gonna get week to week. Charlie, thank you so much.
You bet.
All right, well, a blockbuster superhero movie deserves a good spoof. But Mark Harrington, with this week's Friday Film Review, says you'll have to keep waiting.
This week's film is Thunder Force, starring Melissa McCarthy, Octavia Spencer, and Jason Bateman in yet another new riff on the superhero genre. McCarthy plays Lydia, a Chicago roughneck who befriends the super smart but not nerdy Emily, played by Octavia Spencer. Lydia and Emily are childhood friends who band together to survive the torments of bullying faced by school-age kids. But bullying isn't their only peril. After a mysterious beam hits Earth, a small number of people start to develop superpowers. However, only evil people get the powers, and the supervillain psychopaths become known as miscreants who quickly wreak havoc on humanity. One such event results in the death of Emily's parents. Emily dedicates her scientific mind to defeating the miscreants. When Emily realizes that Lydia is inhibiting her school performance and risking her goal, Emily breaks off with an underachieving friend to concentrate on making superheroes out of good people to fight the miscreants. Fast forward 20 years, and down and nearly out Lydia hopes to use a class reunion to reconcile with Emily. When Emily doesn't show, Lydia crashes Emily's lab and mistakenly injects herself with Emily's brand new superhero serum. Problem is, only one person can get it. There's a second serum, but it is limited to invisibility. Furious, Emily takes the invisibility dose, and the two set out reluctantly to fight the miscreants together. Thunder Force is written and directed by McCarthy's husband, Ben Falcone, and well, let's just say maybe they should do something more fun as a couple, like crash funerals. Seriously, the only way I could find any entertainment value in this movie was to think of a smart but not nerdy drinking game. Every time a joke falls flat and simultaneously involves a scene with a synonym of falling flat, take a shot. Think bombs, collapses, craters, fails, flames out, flops, flunks, misses, strikes out, tanks, washes out, crashes, crumbles, or implodes. To paraphrase Jaws, you're going to need a bigger bottle. So, on my ski trail rating system, Thunder Force earns my worst Bunny Hill ski trail rating. Watching McCarthy try to stay funny with no support from the script or the rest of the cast is more painful than the face injections we were forced to watch repeatedly. Octavia Spencer's role is so confined to the boring personality of a lab rat, it's like watching a lawyer in a law show just do real law stuff. Thunder Force is rated PG-13 for action, violence, language, repeated cheek trauma, and sexually suggestive crab claws. Thunder Force is streaming on Netflix. This is Mark Harrington for KPCW's Friday Film Review.
Our first guest today is Kevin Hines. He's a mental health advocate, global speaker, best-selling author, and documentary filmmaker who reaches audiences all over the world with his incredible story of unlikely survival and his strong will to live. Kevin was diagnosed with bipolar disorder when he was just a teenager and then attempted to take his own life by jumping from San Francisco's Golden Gate Bridge. He survived. Kevin will discuss his process for wellness, resilience, and recovery in his Hope Heals presentation over Zoom as part of Mental Health Awareness Month in Wasatch County on April 21st at 6:45 p.m. Kevin, good morning, and thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. I want to get to your story in a moment, but I first want to ask you about the stigma around mental health and suicide. What is the most misunderstood thing about suicide, and why is it so important to change that perception?
I think one of the most misunderstood things about suicide and mental health is that it's a death sentence, that you can't break free from it, find hope, find healing, find recovery. I've lived 20 years past the day I should have died off the Golden Gate Bridge, and I still live with regular thoughts of ending my life. But I'll never die that way, because I finally have the ability to recognize through self-awareness techniques that I deserve to be here until my natural end. And I think that for people who are suicidal, if they can recognize their true value and do the hard work it takes to get better mentally, they can survive their pain. I think we often believe these thoughts in our head, but our thoughts don't have to become our actions. You know, if we can recognize our thoughts don't have to own, rule, and define what we do next, then we never have to attempt in the first place. And that's how I've survived all these years with these thoughts, is that I don't let my thoughts determine what I do next. I actually ask for help. The first thing I say when I become suicidal is four simple but effective words: I need help now. And if the first person I turn to is not willing to help me, I turn to the next and the next until someone's willing to empathize with my pain and get me to a place of safety.
Mm-hmm. And one of your mantras is this saying, a pain shared is a pain halved. And you mentioned when you do have these thoughts, you say, I need help now. Why is it so important to talk to other people about what you're feeling and what you're thinking?
Well, it's so important, because if you just live inside yourself and then you internalize it, and then you get to a place where you attempt and you have no one to help save you, you could potentially end up dying by suicide. But if you open up about the pain you're experiencing to anyone, to everyone, you're going to find people that care. I can't tell you on the amount of fingers and toes I have how many times I've thought of suicide. It's been thousands, if not more, and in these last 20 years. And every time it happens, I've been able to stay alive by saying those four simple but effective words. And so my suggestion to people out there who are going through this is that, you know, I know not everybody has a great support network. I recognize that. But if you ask for help to the right people, you're going to get it. You know, for example, in America, we have the crisis text line. And if you text CNQR to 741-741, you're going to have someone that's going to reach you in a matter of seconds. And they have that in Canada as well. They're creating a the text line in the UK as well. So I think that, you know, if we can be bold enough to ask for help, we can survive. Next to that, if people that are doing well mentally, people that are doing good, can be more equipped to ask the questions to someone who they think is in pain: are you thinking of killing yourself? Have you made plans to take your life? And do you have the means? Those three questions don't put the thought in someone's mind that actually gives someone permission to speak on their pain. And like you said, I do say, a pain shared is a pain halved.
Yeah. And your story is one of the most striking I've heard in a long time. You struggled with your own mental health as a young man and still do, and then attempted to take your own life by jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge. That's a lot for a young man to take on. How old were you when you first started to struggle with your own mental health?
You know, the devastating struggle started at 17. But if I look back at my life, you know, obviously hindsight is always 20/20. But if I look back at my life, I can see the mania began at a much younger age. The manic behavior from the bipolar disorder, the high energy, the high octane feeling, the seeming to be up all the time, and that all happened in grade school. But at 17 is when my brain really broke. I began to have hallucinations, auditory and visual, paranoid delusions, panic attacks where my heart palpitations would occur and I thought I was having a heart attack. It just became unrelenting. And by 19 years of age, I couldn't handle it anymore. And the weight became too much to bear. Now, I wish that the first thing I did when it got that bad was tell my father who I was living with. But instead I turned inward. I turned to my inner critical voice and the voices I was hearing in my head that were seemingly not to my conscience telling me I had to die. And I believed them. And that was my greatest mistake, is that suicidal ideations are the greatest liars we know, and we don't have to believe them.
Mm. And I've heard you talk about that bus ride to the bridge and then realizing on the bus that you didn't want to die. And again, as the moment you left the bridge and you jumped, what could have stopped you that day?
Quite frankly, the single thing that could have stopped me that day, well, two things, was if someone had said, "Are you thinking of killing yourself?" I would have told them the truth. And next to that, if someone had said to me on the bus ride there, "Hey, kid, are you okay? Or brother, something wrong? Or pal, can I help you?" I made a pact with myself that if one person says one of those things or a variation of the three, I'll tell them everything, begging to save me. But instead, the only person to react on that bus was a man who turned to his left, the guy next to him, and pointed at me and said, "What the hell's wrong with that kid?" in an apathetic tone. And so that's the sad part about this society, is we can see someone in quite literally the greatest lethal emotional pain they've ever experienced and feel nothing for them but fear of them and apathy toward them. And I disagree with that notion. I think that if we're nothing else on this planet, we're supposed to be here for one another. It's our purpose to give back to each other. And I think if we can learn that, those of us that are doing well, we could be the catalyst for change in someone that's not.
Mm. And one of the most incredible parts of your story is actually how a sea lion helped keep you afloat in the bay until the Coast Guard was able to pick you up. You've said you first thought it was a shark, but you now call the sea lion your guardian angel. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. I named him Herbert just for kicks. And when I was in the water, I couldn't stay above water. I kept going down. I'd swim to the surface. I'd get pulled down and go down. And I couldn't stay above the surface. And that's when something began circling beneath me. And I believed it was a shark, and I freaked out and I was trying to punch it because I was afraid it was going to bite me at any moment. But it turned out from the accounts of people that were on the bridge looking down, and some of them had taken pictures, there was a sea lion circling beneath me, bumping me up. And no longer was I wading in the water to stay afloat. I was now lying atop it on my back, being kept a buoyant by this creature. The sea lion absolutely saved my life because it didn't leave from beneath me until I heard the Coast Guard boat murmur behind me. And so the creature takes off, Coast Guard fishes me out of the water. And, you know, if that sea lion hadn't been there, I would have drowned. And that it's fascinating to me because this mammal that doesn't speak my language came to my aid where no human would. And that blows my mind.
Absolutely.
I'm very blessed to be alive. And I do believe it was my guardian angel, yes.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like the sea lion was that person you needed on the bus or the bridge saying, hey, are you all right?
It really was. That's exactly how I feel. You nailed it on the head. Yeah, you got it.
And how long after your attempted suicide were you comfortable talking about it and sharing your story with people?
You know, it's interesting. I had no intention of ever sharing my story. I was embarrassed. I felt ashamed from what I did. And I felt that I hurt a lot of people, which I did. I hurt a lot of people. Because everyone came forward and was like, why didn't you call me? I would have been there for you. You know, but I couldn't see it when I was still sick. And I couldn't see that people cared that much about me. And I wish I could go back in time and tell my father that morning what I was thinking. Because it would have changed the outcome of that day.
Absolutely.
But my brain was trying to kill me as I was desperately trying to cling to life.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Fascinating. So let's talk a little bit about your Hope Heals presentation that's going to be happening on April 21st as part of Wasatch County's Mental Health Awareness Month. What can people expect from this presentation?
They can expect to hear a story that's multifaceted, rooted in someone being born in pain. I was born in squalor with birth parents that were on drugs after they had us, me and my brother. And they can expect a story of an individual who's gone through foster care, into adoption, into a beautiful family, and then whose brain breaks at 17, attempts to take his life at 19, and then goes on this journey for the next 10, 15 years of self-discovery and finding and obtaining wellness and building a routine and a regimen to stay mentally well. So they're going to hear all about that and about how anyone can build a routine and regimen that's similar. I call mine the Art of Wellness, and I really, truly give it out to all of my presentations for anyone to take home and to enact in their own life, to change their own life. Thousands of people from around the world, from as far as Peru, Africa, China, Japan, all across Europe, and have said that this 10-step Art of Wellness plan has dramatically changed their life in 6 to 9 months of following it. And so I give that out for free to anyone willing to listen, because I want them to change their lives. And I really want them to understand that the only way to develop good mental health habits and to be mentally stable is through hard work, dedication, and drive to stabilize. It's not easy. It's not going to come overnight. And if you do the work, if you put in the hours and put in the time, you can better your mental, brain, mind, behavioral, and spiritual health and well-being. If anyone who wants to register for this event can go to Caring Community Coalition of Wasatch County's Facebook page, April 21st, 6:45 p.m., event starts. So love to have anybody there willing to sign up and be a part of it. Just as a side note, my second book is now out, called The Third Rail, In My Mania I Became. And it's a story of a great friend of mine, a man I call a brother named Jesse Cohen, who tragically lost his life to suicide. But we were working on this book together before he did. And my wife, his wife and I, his widow and I, finished the book together along with some friends. And it is one of those powerful pieces describing what it's like to live with bipolar mania. And to And it's a book that could give someone of hope, even though Jesse's life ended tragically. It could definitely help.
Absolutely. Anything else you want to share with us this morning, Kevin?
You know, I just want to share with you guys that if you're going through that kind of pain right now and you're really hurting, I'm begging you, don't silence your pain. Don't keep it inside. Tell someone about your pain so you can be free from it. Tell someone about your pain so you can survive it. You deserve this life until your natural end. And suicide never has to be the solution to your problem. It is the problem. You're beautiful just as you are, and you're meant to be here. Be here tomorrow.
Wonderful. Kevin, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate you joining us, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
Thank you for having me. Take care.
Take care. Well, next on the line, we have the executive director of the Park City Institute, Ari Ioannidis. He has details about tomorrow's sidewalk sale of old Institute items. Ari, good morning.
How are you?
I'm doing well. Enjoying some of this snow. It's been some funky weather out lately.
Too bad our resorts aren't open, right?
Oh, I know, right? I was driving in this morning and saw, like, probably a good foot of snow along Deer Valley Drive. I was like, man, it's a powder day.
It is.
Absolutely. So I understand the Institute will be having a sidewalk sale tomorrow. Over 20 years of swag that has been collected will be for sale. Is that correct?
Yeah. During COVID, the staff has been looking for stuff to do. And one of the things we decided to do was hit these three big rooms of, I'm going to call them archives, of stuff that we've just collected. From all of the shows that we've done. So, and not only that, but a couple of years ago, we closed down the Mega Genius store. So there are also a good bit of items left over from the store. So it's just time to share it. We put together a sale that will make these things available to the public. And we're going to use the funds to throw a little party for the staff. They've been working really hard during COVID, and We wanted a big thank you to the folks who have helped keep us open.
Mm-hmm. What have been some of your favorite pieces of swag over the last 20 years that people might be able to snag tomorrow?
Well, for me, really probably the best things are vinyl. I love listening to music, and records are just really, you know, something for me that, you know, forces you to sit down, put the needle in the groove, listen to 45 minutes of music, turn the record over, listen to the other side. So for me, that would be it. We also have some CDs, but lots of t-shirts, and we've got them sorted by size. Yeah. So, you know, small, even children sizes, medium, large, extra large. We've got banners and chairs and water bottles and rulers and, cool little Mega Genius lunchbox kits with stuff in it. We've got balls, children's toys. I mean, we can go on and on and on about all the stuff we have. We have even life-sized cutouts of artists. You know, so if you're a fan of Colby Calais and you want a full-size poster of Colby Calais in your house, we've got that. Just tons and tons of stuff, flashlights, water bottles, really a lot of things.
Sounds like there could be some hidden gems in there. So let's talk a little bit about some of these summer events. I was looking at your calendar before the show this morning. It sounds like you guys have things scheduled for July. Is that correct?
Yeah, I have a pretty good confidence that we'll be open in July. What we're being told is that soon as Summit County gets back to the low transmission level, we're at moderate right now, that we'll be able to open the theater. We have to plan usually about 6 months ahead of time to get an artist, because unlike some of the other great performing arts community presenters in the area, we tend to present national artists, and for them to plan to come to Park City, it takes time and coordination. So we've planned a great lineup, all things considering. Things change because, you know, it's a strange year still. But, you know, we'll have a socially distanced, really great season. And I'm excited about the variety this year.
Gotcha. And do we have an idea when tickets might be going on sale for that?
So we, my accountant wants me to put tickets on sales now, but just out of an abundance of caution, we've lined everything up so that we could cancel or postpone a show as late as 30 days before the show. This is kind of not the way the industry works, but because of COVID, people are getting interested in this. So we've put that in place just to make sure that everyone has a good deal of confidence that the show will happen. Tickets will go on sale roughly 30 days prior to each one of the shows. Now, if things start looking really, really good, we'll go ahead and open up the entire season.
Gotcha. Anything else you want to share with us this morning, Ari?
No, that's about it. If you are interested in coming to any of those shows, you can go to our website and see a list with the dates, so you can mark them on your calendar. There's also a button there. A lot of people have already done this. You click on the button and say, notify me when the tickets go on sale, and we'll add you to that list so that the moment they go on sale, you can get the best tickets.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining, Ari. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Sean. Have a great day.
All right. That's Executive Director of the Park City Institute, Ari Ioannidis. Their sidewalk sale is tomorrow at 1244 B Iron Horse Drive in the parking lot behind the Windy Ridge Restaurant, 10 to 2 p.m. That's tomorrow. Next up on the line, we have Park City Councilor Max Doylny with a recap of last night's city council meeting. Max, good morning, and thank you for joining us.
Yeah, good morning, Sean.
All right. So council kicked off yesterday with an update on summer events. Obviously, 4th of July is the big one on the calendar this year. It's on everyone's minds. With more than 75% of all eligible adults vaccinated in Summit County, Park City is looking into resuming special events this summer. And from what I understand, you're looking at a 20% reduction in events. Is that the number of events or the amount of people that we'll be allowing at some of these events over the summertime?
Well, it's more of just an overall goal, right? We're trying to, you know, and special events is going through the process of coming up with tools on how to reduce the event size, or at least try and limit those event sizes to the best of our ability. But as you well know, every event has a, you know, has a different dynamic. Some are gated, some are, you know, on public streets, et cetera. So they're working with the event organizers and just trying to come up with different creative ways to limit the population that comes into town and enjoys the events while being able to still hold those events.
Mm-hmm. And looking at some of these bigger events, I mean, 4th of July is obviously a huge event, but Silly Market, we seem to have over about like 1,400 guests turning out every Sunday. How effective will just a 20% reduction be?
Well, you know, again, I think that's going to be something we're going to figure out as we go on. It's really hard to predict public behavior, right? I mean, as the vaccines roll out, people feel more comfortable or less comfortable. I know there's, you know, some social anxiety out there, but for, you know, we're just elected officials. We can't predict public behavior. So we're just trying to use the tools at our disposal to either give people the opportunity to spread out a little bit. For instance, during Silly Sundays, we're going to have, you know, the upper part of Main Street's going to be open as well. So there's a lot more space for people to spread out and walk around the street. Hopefully they'll do that. Hopefully people will still be respectful of one another when they're within 6 feet of each other wearing masks. All the businesses on Main Street, I've noticed most of them are still requiring people to wear masks when they come inside. And I think that that's a responsible action. And we hope that the messaging and that the people coming to visit will respect Park City and our wishes that people still wear masks when they're in close contact and when they're in businesses.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of some of these businesses, car-free Sundays were very popular last summer, and they look to be coming back this year. Some businesses absolutely love that the roads were closed, and they helped them have, in some cases, record years in the middle of a pandemic. But others said it actually hurt them financially. Have you had some kind of pushback from the business community on car-free Sundays?
Yeah, you know, we're really sensitive to this because there's not really a panacea for how to address every single issue that comes up, right? I know that some galleries had a hard time getting you know, their works of art in and out of people's cars. People like to park right outside the front door. We learned that on our walk and talks last year. Other galleries did pretty well. They had more people walking in front of their door. You know, it's one of these things. Every time you make a change, you're going to have some who benefit and others who don't. But I'm not sure we saw a super clear delineation last year, and HPCA has put it out to their group, and their recommendation to us was that they wanted car-free Sundays. And so we kind of, you know, we take that pretty seriously. When they've done their work, we listen to their wishes.
Mm-hmm. And given that these events draw in a great number of people from outside of not just Park City, but Summit County, even if the majority of people in Summit County do become vaccinated, what kind of steps are being taken to mitigate the risk of people who possibly aren't vaccinated at all coming to town for some of these events?
Yeah, again, Sean, it's you know, this is a really difficult issue, and the unknowns are still plentiful, right? This time last year, we had no idea what we were going to do about summer, and we kind of had to scramble and figure it out. The good news is that the majority of our population are going to be protected from those other people. The other good news is that Utah in general is doing pretty darn good job of vaccinations. The country is doing better than we thought it would be doing. And so we're hoping that, you know, as we get more and more people vaccinated, the risks continue to reduce. And, you know, the drive market really drove a lot of our business last year. We anticipate that that will be the case this year. As international markets are still closed, we think that we're still going to have a pretty robust national market coming to town, and most of that's going to be driving. But to ask me whether I know what the exact risk is going to be for you when you go out to enjoy your day, I think each individual is going to have to make their own decisions on what they're comfortable with.
Right. And the city also discussed possible improvements to the rail trail, entering into a interlocal agreement with Utah State Parks about maintenance and improvements for the part of the trail between Bonanza Drive and 248. I believe that's about 2.75 miles worth of trail. The council gave an enthusiastic yes to explore this project, with you guys even asking it to be done in a shorter amount of time. What are the chances of that process moving along quicker than, I believe, the 5-year timeline that was presented last night?
Well, you know, these things are really, it's hard to predict, right? Because we have to actually do the first step, which is get the interlocal agreement done with the state parks. I don't think most people realize that Park City didn't and never has had control over the rail trail and its upkeep. And the state parks had made made it clear to us that they were capable of doing a good job of keeping that trail in good condition and upkeeping the on the trash cans and the little spots where you to stop and sit. But it hasn't really lived up to what we expected. And so now we're trying to cut a deal with them where we can take over that responsibility and make it fit a little better with the wishes of Park City residents. I live over in Prospector. I use the rail trail on a daily basis. It's super busy over there, but it's almost like a outdoor community hub, right? You see your friends, you see people walking their dogs, riding their bikes, kids playing. It needs a little attention, and we just thought it best that we get involved because it's right in the heart of our town.
Absolutely. Rail trail is a great bike path, rollerblading path, just walking path in the summertime.
Yeah, we're a little bit, you know, one of the things that Nan brought up was, you know, if we can get that thing striped, that'll help a lot in terms of safety. You know, people are on bikes going 20, 30 miles an hour down that trail, a dog jumps out. It can be a little bit dangerous, and we want to try and add some safety measures, add some little zones in there where you can sit off to the side, and just enhance the whole community aspect of that part of Park City. And I think it's going to be a huge community benefit.
Mm-hmm. And as it pertains to possibly widening the trail, I think we all remember how much pushback there was to the possibility of widening 248. What is that process like to actually widen the rail trail? Will there be a public input process? Do you expect pushback on widening the rail trail?
I don't anticipate pushback on widening the rail trail. Again, we're going to have to do sort of a master plan and look at what we think, what would be the best improvements, what we can afford. We'll have to move some money around to make sure that we can make it happen. Heinrich Dieter's done, you know, a phenomenal job of managing these types of projects. And you know, he made it pretty clear, hey, let's do step one first and make sure we have control before we get too far out over our skis here. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And with more people looking to get outside since the start of the pandemic, there's a very high demand for more walkable areas around town, not just with the rail trail, including walking sidewalks through neighborhoods. There was a little bit of discussion last night about the city's active transportation and walkability goals. Where are we with that, and what can we expect in other parts of town?
Well, there are a significant number of projects on the horizon for walkability. Steve mentioned that, you know, we were talking about it a lot 5 years ago, and he felt like it kind of fell flat with a whole lot of, you know, bigger, shinier things coming across the, you know, our desk. But I think in recent months, you've been hearing more of us bring up walkability. And so it's a high priority in terms of what project lands where. There are plans, and I'm sorry, I don't have the meeting in front of me where we went through all of the different projects we have planned, but it's definitely a high priority, and they're starting to work on, you know, bits and pieces all the time, whether it's in, you know, widening sidewalks. That's going to start happening around white arts and culture, you know, safer ways to get across some of our busy roads. There are dozens and dozens of projects on the horizon.
Mm-hmm. And I understand council looked at using 15% of transit funds going towards walkability. What are the benefits of allotting more money towards active transportation projects compared to, say, other projects on 224, 248 with buses?
Well, we're definitely not taking our eye off the ball, which is getting people out of their cars and onto any other form of transportation, right? I mean, the more people who are in a car by themselves, the worse traffic gets. So if we can get people out of their cars, you know, Andy mentioned, hey, if we're going to be looking at any of these things, I sure would like to see staff be actively looking at ways to, you know, enhance our car-free town, right? Our car-free livability in Park City. So that's the goal. And whether we're transferring funds from one place to another for specifically buses or specifically walkability, the overall goal is to get people out of their cars, get them talking to each other on the rail trail, get them on one of our e-bikes, or get them on the buses. And whatever we can do to sort of achieve that goal, those are going to be the priorities. And we may have to shift things over time, but this is the first step in that direction, or not the first. This is one of the many steps in that direction.
Right. And I want to ask you about this, the Daily West mine headframe. The headframe collapsed in 2015 after the mine caved in. And last summer, the city agreed to move the headframe about 150 feet to re-erect, repair, and preserve the structure. I understand the council approved advancement of about $120,000 worth of contributions over the next few years. What is the process of actually moving this structure and erecting it, and what other hurdles does the city have to jump over?
Well, so the process, I'm not the engineer on this, but it was really interesting to read through the staff report and then get the update last night. We're going to take out the pieces of metal on that headframe that got mangled when it fell over, but we're going to try and mimic the design. We're going to use a bolt structure rather than a rivet structure, but it's going to look very similar. Everywhere we can use the old metal, we're going to use it. We're moving that structure just over to a more stable piece of ground, but it's going to look quite similar to where to its original sort of aspect when you look out of the montage or where you're riding on the Mid-Mountain Trail or anything like that. And but to part of your question, I'm actually really curious to see how this all comes together, right? I'm interested in these projects, and I think it's going to be cool to see this thing stand back up. There was a suggestion of any of the old metal that doesn't get, you know, that doesn't get used to reconstruct it. Maybe we can get somebody to do a piece of public art with that metal. That way you can kind of see how incredible the work is from 100 years ago. These guys up there, you know, doing this by hand, pretty impressive piece of engineering.
Absolutely. And you mentioned this will be moved to a more stable piece of ground. So there's a guarantee that there isn't another mine shaft beneath where this new site is that could potentially collapse in the future?
No, there's no guarantee that there's no mine shaft beneath it, because there are tunnels and shafts all over Park City. And that was one of the conversations we had last night. But for several hundred feet below where it will be placed, there is nothing that we have detected so far. So it's a stable piece of ground, and that's the whole point of moving it there. Obviously, they, you know, we do the work to make sure that it's going to not crumble again. And then when we construct it in a way that it's safe for people to be around, because, you know, that's one of our big goals with any of our historic sites around Park City, is to make sure that they're safe, but that we can still see them and enjoy them and make them a part of our, you know, continue to make them a part of our history.
Absolutely. And I understand this area could eventually reopen to skiers. What kind of hazards does that present?
Well, I think what they said is that they, you know, they haven't considered every option yet, but the old mine shaft has to remain open. They get fresh air through that vent, and they did a little mitigation effort on it for now. But they suggested maybe they'll build some sort of a building around it. Maybe it's an open air building. I'm not, you know, it wasn't totally clear, because I don't think they know exactly how they're going to do that. But obviously safety is, you know, the top priority, and trying to make it fit in with the surrounding environment, et cetera, et cetera. All of those things will be taken into account. They have to work with the Historic Preservation Board, et cetera, to figure out what they're going to do with that. But the hole does have to remain open. Air has to get in there for a number of different reasons.
Mm-hmm. And one last question before you go. Arts and culture was not on the agenda this week, but we expect it to be back later this month. How has that process been going for you, and what can we expect at the next city council meeting?
You know, Sean, we want to move forward on that as quickly as possible, but quite frankly, it was kind of nice to have a meeting without it dominating the entire evening. How's the process going for me? It's super interesting. We're having conversations all the time. We want to come to a conclusion. We want to give our partners a firm answer on what we're doing. I feel like it's a good project. I really like the idea, but, you know, I think the price is really where we're landing on, you know, it might be a little too expensive. So we might have to sharpen our pencil and figure out how to get it done so that we get a win-win for the community. But I think it's the right thing to do.
Absolutely. Well, we look forward to that discussion. Councillor Max Doyle, thank you so much for joining us this morning. We really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks, Sean. Have a wonderful day.
You as well. Take care. On to local news. The Summit County Council on Wednesday met again on the appeal from the Wildway Ranch indoor riding area and horse boarding facility, but they have not come to a decision yet. Rick Bruff has more.
The council heard from both sides, held a brief executive session, and decided to take the matter further under advisement. The Wildway Ranch, proposed for Lower Silver Creek, got a negative recommendation from the Snyderville Planning Commission late last year. In February, an appeal went to the county council, and they remanded it to the Snyderville planners after the appellant agreed to make some changes. On Wednesday, Deputy County Attorney Jamie Bracken reported the Planning Commission was asked to look at three issues during the remand session. She said the panel agreed that Wildway Ranch was compliant on two items, architectural requirements and the materials, but the Planning Commission, she said, again denied the project because it was lacking in a, quote, human scale.
There was a conversation about, well, if it's not human scale, what is it? And they talked about, well, maybe it's an airplane scale. In other words, as viewed from above, or maybe it's, you know, vehicle scale. And in the conversations with the Planning Commission, what they determined was that this was really at an equestrian, not human scale, that the size and the shape and the size was based on an equestrian scale, not a human scale.
The attorney for the ranch, Brent Bateman, said his client, Valerie Guest, has done everything asked from her by the planning staff and the county code, but the requirement for a so-called human scale is too subjective.
There is no way that my client could possibly look at human scale and know what it means, know what they need to do in order to comply. We've tried to zero in on that as much as possible. And that has included discussions with staff about what human scale means. And that has included discussions with architects about what human scale means. And we have added aspects to this application in order to meet human scale as near as we can zero in on it.
Bateman added that the county's own staff agreed they met the human scale test. Valerie Geist also spoke briefly, noting that she gets passionate about her application. She said she isn't proposing the facility for a commercial use.
I don't think people understand what this is for. First of all, it's like my home, and my horses are they're like my family, and I want them to live on a property with me. And I have struggled for 8 years now having to rent. This is not open to the public, big commercial horse boarding. It's my private home with a small barn, and my horses are high-end dressage horses, and they're very delicate. And in order for me to live in Park City with horses, I have to be able to ride and exercise them in the winter. You can't do that outside in snow.
She said she would have preferred a smaller scale project, but had to follow the county's building code.
The arena is actually bigger than it needs to be because we had to put facade shifts and pop out porticos and all kinds of things on there to satisfy all these architectural requirements. It would be a lot safer to have two small buildings. It would actually be safer to just build a small indoor arena under 10,000 square feet, a separate stable building. I don't even want them to be attached, but I had to attach them. I'm going to have to put a fire door to separate the two buildings.
Council member Glenn Wright told KPCW that in their discussion, the council talked about the size of the structures, and council member Chris Robinson suggested moving some buildings around so they wouldn't impact neighbors as much. However, Wright said he couldn't give any details on what was discussed in closed session. For KPCW, I'm Rick Baroff.